The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 25, 2005. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. I'd like to talk about a basic teaching of the Buddha, the middle way, or the avoidance of extremes. I first became acquainted with this teaching as a boy, actually, when I was about 8 or 9, 10 maybe. My oldest brother, who's 12 years older than me, was in college at the time and was learning about a lot of things, of course, but Eastern, got into some Eastern thought and that sort of thing. And he told me about the Buddha and Buddhism. He was somewhat taken by that at the time, which, of course, really impressed me. You know, as a little kid, your older brother. I mean, he was a grown-up, you know, and he was very influential in my life, actually, at that time. Anyway, I remember on a number of occasions he would talk to me about different things that he'd learned about Buddhism, among other things. And I could tell that he was interested, so I kind of listened up. And one of the things that really impressed me at that time was the story of the Buddha, how he, as a young prince, had everything that you could desire. All the material wants of life, you know, were supplied to him. And that sort of thing, at least for people of his time and place. He was pretty well off. And he lived a life of luxury, I guess we could say. At least these were the impressions I was getting. Of course, we all know the story. His father sheltered him from viewing any kind of misery. But eventually, he discovered old age, sickness, and death, and was very troubled by that and left his father's palace and then began to practice with the sattus, the ascetics, the holy men that were practicing various kinds of practices. And some were very severe and strenuous. And the Buddha, for the next several years, 6 years or so, actually brought himself very close to the point of death by practicing some of these extreme practices. That somehow, if we're going to free ourselves from this world of suffering that he had suddenly become alarmed by, that he had to go to this extreme practice of one kind or another. Well, as a story, and there's various versions of the story. I'm sure most of you know these. But the upshot of it is basically that after 6 years, finally one day, he was near starvation, but someone came and gave him a little bit of food. Different story will tell you different things. But he took a little bit of nourishment and suddenly realized he was regaining his strength. His mental faculties coming back after being very dulled, maybe, through all these practices. And then he vowed to get to the bottom of this issue. And within 8 days, the 8th morning, sitting there after taking this nourishment, he awoke with the rising of the morning star, which, of course, would be the planet Venus. And that's the story. But out of this, then, you see, we have this teaching of the middle way. I remember my brother telling me about this, that it's the middle way, or the avoidance of extremes. It's avoiding the extremes of living a life of just wanton pleasure and pleasure-seeking and just opulence and luxury and all of that. To avoid that extreme, that is not the religious life. That is not for one who really wants to get to the bottom of this issue of human existence. And the Buddha then left that extreme, but then, of course, he went to the opposite extreme, which is what we do. Because of our minds, we think dualistically. We see the world in dualistic terms. We believe the world is this way. And if we reject this over here, we go over there and we embrace the opposite, which is what he did. And at the time, as a little boy, I didn't fully appreciate. I mean, I could understand just the, you know, the kind of the gist of the story is, yeah, you don't live this, you know, life of luxury, but you go over here and you live this life of want and deprivation. That's not so good either. You weaken your body, your mind, and you're not really ripe now for the spiritual path, you know, the path to awakening. So we need to avoid these extremes. And I got that picture as a kid. And I think I also sensed, perhaps, I don't know, that there's some depth to this. There's something more to this. And there is. There's a lot more to it. It's kind of a metaphor for how we really get caught, and not even so much how we get, I mean, we're caught, but it's a metaphor for how we don't seem to be able to free ourselves from the kind of bondage that we put ourselves in. And the bondage, of course, that we put ourselves in is of our own making, really, though we do it out of our ignorance. We don't mean to bind ourselves. Who would want to do that? We don't realize that we're doing this. We don't realize how we're doing it, that we're doing it sometimes. So we're caught up in our thinking, our way of viewing the world, what we tell ourselves, what we believe, and not even maybe fully realizing how this keeps us bound to this life of ignorance and confusion and fear and longing and loathing. So this story of the middle way, or the avoidance of extremes, is really all about that. About how it is that we don't seem to be able to find our way out of this situation, which is really where most of us are. We're caught in this and we don't quite know how to get out. And then we see certain kinds of practices, Zen practices, you know, different kinds of practices, different kinds of meditation, many kinds of meditation, other practices as well. There's even just kind of forgetting the whole thing and just go out and enjoy yourself. That's a practice. So we take up many different kinds of things. And some of us become very cynical because nothing really seems to, you know, if we haven't completely glossed our minds over so we don't really realize there's a problem here, and we've actively tried to do something about this issue. We take up a religious path, a belief, whatever, or we take up something I'll practice like Zen, whatever. But somehow we don't seem to be able to get out of the problem that we're stuck in. And that's what this avoidance of extremes, the middle way, actually helps us with. If we can begin to understand it. You see, it isn't just simply that metaphor of avoiding the life of these extremes. It really begins to tell us how we go from one extreme to the other in the case of everything. Even to the point, and we talk about this in the Dependent Arising class and elsewhere, even to the point where these extremes are such that we're caught in the extremes of even existence and non-existence, being and nothingness. We think that this is actually a real case. Well, actually, most of us are just kind of caught up in being and existence, thinking that there's something solid here that is being lived out and that we can grasp. We're not really making too much sense of this nothingness stuff. But when we see the end of our life here or whatever, then we see it as maybe a kind of nothingness. Or maybe we put something else there. But still, if we put something else there, we're still caught in existence again. I go on after I die. I go to heaven. I go to hell. Something else. Or there's nothing. It's just these extremes. Now, when Stephen Batchelor was here, he had talked about this. It's kind of a big problem that we have, particularly among philosophers,
people of that ilk, people that do a lot of thinking.
Problem is, why is there something as opposed to nothing? I remember Stephen brought up this question, talked about it a bit.
But I happen to know from reading, I try to keep up a little bit with different kind of philosophical things that are being tossed about in our culture, and I've run across this frequently, that apparently this seems to be a very deep problem for us. It's like the deepest mystery. Why is there something as opposed to nothing? What we don't recognize in these very intelligent people who have thought these things through and discussed them actually for centuries, it's the same thing. They're stuck and they can't get out of where they're stuck. In fact, much of the time they don't even realize that they're stuck or how it is that they're stuck. Well, how are we stuck? Well, like most of us, they're stuck in the notion of being, in existence. And the only alternative seems to be something ludicrous like nothing, nothingness. Well, of course we don't have nothingness. I mean, look, this is not nothing. So we just keep coming back to being. Or we think, you know, maybe after I die, I disappear and that's it, it's all over. Unless I think I go on. Well, this is just being stuck in these. Why are we stuck in these extremes? Well, it's because we actually, you know, think there's something there that we can get hold of. We don't seem to notice, at least not easily, that you've never gotten hold of anything. Look very carefully at what you think you've got, what you think you are. You've got a self. Well, that seems quite real. We quite draw that into question. Is now it seems like we're heading into the world of kind of abstraction, and you know, the concrete thing is that there's a self here. But of course, what are we talking about, this self? What we actually directly experience is that you don't find that, you see. But until we really digest this and realize it and see it directly for ourselves, we remain caught in these extremes. And we also don't understand the subtle teaching that goes on around us. Like right here, I'll say different things. And you think I'm saying something solid. Oh, sensei says. And then you might argue with it. Or you bring it back to me. And then you say, well, you said this. And I said, I did? I don't remember. Give me the context. When did this happen? Because I said it at a time and a place when something was happening. And I was probably speaking of that. Now, I remember with my teacher, one time, there was a big debate was going on about these avatars, you know. Did I tell you this story? People were saying one time that, you know, was working or whatever, and people were just kind of throwing the zabutons down, and some had the tassels up and some had the tassels down, you know. And somebody said, no, Roshi says that tassels should be up, you know. Is that right, you know, tassels up? Or somebody went to ask him then, and he says tassels up or whatever. And Roshi says tassels up. So religiously, you know, tassels are up. And once in a while, after a while, of course, people didn't hear that message. And they're starting to put the zabutons now with tassels down. Oh, no. We don't realize that we're caught. Right there, we're caught. We're caught in the extremes, you see. Roshi was a Zen master. He knows better than this. He's not caught. But he said tassels up. Yeah. People argue, well, you know, with the tassels up, you know, you can kind of, you know, it's not as comfortable as if the tassels were done. Like it's like the princess and the pea. But I do remember that argument that it was probably a little less comfortable if the tassels were up. Got those little knots, you know, just pressing into you there or something, you know. Or somebody thought, too, that I think there was some other argument for that. So flip them over. Went to say, Roshi, you know. If we, you know, flip him over, maybe gave him the argument, I don't know. He says, yeah, tassels down, fine. Okay, now it's the tassels down, you know. But well, I heard him say, no, we got something we can fight about. the abstraction is this tassel, subtassel, but the reality is we're fighting. Because in our minds we've made something solid here. And we don't realize that we're talking to a Zen master. Zen masters will say things. You know that story of the fellow who, the Zen master, never smiled? On his deathbed, one of his students came in to see him and just inquire how he was and everything. And the Zen master just frowning, you know. And he wanted me to, you know, show me your understanding, he says, you know. So the student slides his medicine toward the teacher. The teacher just frowns, you know. He says, is that all you understand? And then the student takes the medicine, slides it back to its original position. And then the master smiled and died. Or we have other stories, you know, where the master raises the whisk. One master challenging another, and master raises his whisk. Is that all you understand? And the guy puts the whisk down again. And of course, this all seems like just so much silliness. Anybody can do that. Of course, anybody can do that. But can you do that and understand what you're doing? Because that's the part that will show, at least anybody who sees for themselves what's going on here. Because we live in a world of objects and this and that, seemingly a world full of things, a world of this and that, and now we speak of different things, or we say different things, or we give directions or whatever. Everything appears to be coming out solid. The directives, the words, the objects maybe that are being referred to, it all appears very solid. And we hear the master, the teacher, talking about these things. And we take them all to be solid. Oh, it's like this, or it's like that. Or this is what he wants, or this is what he doesn't want. All he wants, if he's a master you're talking about, is for you to wake up. All he wants is to be awake himself in this moment. That's all he wants. But because things are happening, you know, words are spoken and the directives are made. But for someone who's awake, it is all very liquid, flowing, moving, and changing. There's no particular way, really. How we do a ceremony. How we, like this last week at Sushin, I heard things were done a little differently. Well, that's fine. That's fine. It's probably good that we kind of stake it out ahead of time. What are we going to do? And then are we going to be in agreement just to keep keep some smoothness of the practice? But that's okay. It's, things, you know, get shuffled out and changed. And that's all right. How do we do Orioki? People are interested in having a film. We make a film on how to do the Orioki. But there's no particular way to do the Orioki. We do it like this. And of course, it doesn't stay like this. It evolves. It changes. I imagine the way we do it now isn't at all the way it was when I learned it first with my teacher 30 years ago now. But what I've learned, like when I was in Japan, every place I went, we were doing Orioki differently. I had to just kind of watch and see how things were being done. There isn't any particular way to do it. But we can get caught, you see, in the extreme of thinking that there's a particular way to do Orioki. We get caught in the rigidity because we want something to grasp and something to hold on to. And this is the form, and this is the way it's done, and this is what it means, and this is what it is, and this is how you should do it. And all the while we're doing that, we're not actually just there with the moment, letting it unfold as it will, and every moment will be unique and different from whatever's taken place before. But to the extent that we grasp or we hold to one thing or another, we don't notice that. We don't see that. We think it has to be a certain way. So this is to avoid the extremes. It enters into this. What it's really coming down to, what it's really pointing out for us is how in our minds we grasp and we solidify the world. We make it into something solid. Whatever it is, anything at all. Thoughts, ideas, beliefs, opinions, objects, people, you name it. We just wrap them in a solid identity of some sort and we label it and we carry on. as if the whole world were brittle and frozen, when in fact everything is flowing, everything is liquid. Having said all of that then, and some people get to this point in their understanding of Zen and Zen practice, and then they think everything is kind of flowing and liquid, and so anything goes. Sorry, just be cool and let it flow. Again, we have gone to an extreme. Why? It's because we thought there was a particular way this should be done. The particular way meaning that, hey man, it's all just kind of loose. You see how insidious this is and how subtle it is? We just, you know, and we can't get ourselves unstuck from this until we actually see what we're doing. Do you know how we avoid the extremes? Did I give you the subtle paradox there, the subtle snap on the end of the whip there that just really clinches it that this is a profound issue of confusion? That even if we think, okay, we avoid extremes, and it's not this way, and we just kind of avoid. But then we'll make that into something once again. So how do we live in a world that's like this? That every time we turn our attention to something, or we say something, or we point something out, it suddenly just becomes solid. Of course, it's only solid in our mind. In actuality, nothing's actually formed there. See, this whole issue about why is there something as opposed to nothing? If we look very carefully at our experience, we realize we don't have something as opposed to nothing. It's just this. Get hold of it. You can't. What something do we have here? We don't find something. What? Show me. At the same time, we say, then we go, no, we don't have nothing. So we don't have something in particular. We don't have nothing. We don't have any of these. So now what do we do? How do we live? How do we practice? How do we avoid getting caught in the extremes? We have to recognize the situation that we're in and the subtlety of it. What I've said up till now is the easy part. This is the hard part. If you can understand this, and what I mean understand is not just intellectually get the idea, but you understand it in a way so that you can actually live out of this, you won't have any trouble. But this is what we do. When something comes up, some issue, you've been handed something, somebody's set down the zabaton, something's occurred, you treat whatever it is that you're engaged in, that person, that object, that thought, whatever it is, you treat that as life and death. You engage yourself in the world and your thinking and your practice and with others as life and death. It's all life and death. I'm not pretending about this. That's what it is. It is absolute critical. Okay? Now, we've included that extreme. This is absolutely critical. Whatever it is that you do, that you take it up consciously, deliberately, seriously. This doesn't mean that you can't have fun or tell a joke, but you are serious. You're not just playing with life or dabbling in this or dabbling in that. If you want to take up the Zen way, you can't just dabble in it, you have to take it up. But the same thing is true of anything you do, brushing your teeth, do that. Do it at 100%. It is life and death. It is life and death. You say, well, no, not really, because, you know, maybe my teeth will rot or something, but I'm not going to. No, it is. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about this moment now. Are you here? Because if you're not here and present with it, it's as if, the Buddha said, it's as if you are dead already, right now. So this is absolutely critical that we take this up. Okay, now that's the one extreme. Without letting go of that, we go over here and realize that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So don't get too upset if, well, you name it. The tassels are up, the tassels are down. We say, okay, yeah. But people, I've seen people get really upset. But you get the issue get bigger and bigger. You got a fatal condition. Well, actually, you do. We all do. But let it get as big as you want. And it still doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in a sense that you don't need to be disturbed by that. You don't need to be tossed away. You don't need to be, and just getting carried away one way or another about any issue at all. You name it. There's the other extreme. We include that. Somebody once asked my teacher, he said, you know, you talk about the middle way, but isn't that kind of narrow? But then Roshi, he said, you know, he picked up a piece of chalk or a pencil or something, but he held it kind of between his index finger and his thumb like this. And he said, how are you going to find the middle? How do you find the middle? It is not narrow. To find the middle means you know the whole length and breadth of the whole picture here. Everything. You see the extremes. If you go to the extremes, you don't see the other. You think this is real, and we either dismiss that, or if you do see the other, it's in some kind of, it could easily become some kind of contentious thing. Realize that this is only in our minds where we go to these extremes. Reality gives us all of this together at once. Both of these extremes are included. So if we take up this way, this practice, and this is what we learn to practice ultimately, and it just doesn't mean that you perfected. I certainly haven't perfected living this. But I understand it. That this is life and death, and yet we don't get caught by it. We don't let it chew us up. We don't let it equip us with stuff that will go out and cause a lot of damage against other people. We don't dismiss it. We don't throw it away. Because it's life and death, we deal with it at 100%. And whatever the outcome is, we don't attach to that. But we stay with it. We don't presume, actually, even that there is an outcome, a particular outcome, because it never stops, because it is all fluid and ever-changing. And so we learn to just stay with it and stay with it. We never settle down in thinking we've got the answer, that we've got something that we can grasp or hold here. We know that that would be death the moment we take hold of something and we've frozen it and we start treating and acting as if I've got something here. That we're living out of delusion and out of confusion, and we're going to live in such a way that's going to disturb people. Cause a lot of trouble for you and for others. It's the human world of misery that we're creating. We don't need to do that. So this is the hard part, to realize that it is life and death. And when I say it is life and death, I don't mean to pretend that it's life and death or to act as if it were life and death. I want you to entertain the thought that, you know, you can see that it actually is. This is it. This is most critical, that you're here, in other words. Absolutely critical. And at the same time, it doesn't matter what is happening, what is unfolding in this moment. You know, you don't need to attach to it. You need to deal with it. You need to take care of it. You need to be responsible. You need to be present. But you don't need to force it, to hold it, to freeze it, to attach to it, to insist on it, to push it through. All of that kind of stuff that we do, we'll insist on the moment to be a particular way, is not necessary. It is not for you to change it or to shape it or to make it into this or that, but to just be there with it, be present, and to see what is unfolding in this moment. This is how we embrace the extremes. We don't go to either extreme. We embrace the extremes, and this is how we find the middle way. So that's why, like, our practice, tassels up or down, we can say one way or the other. Maybe if we get things a little organized, it helps just to kind of compose and settle the room a little bit. That's good. So we can either have tassels up, tassels down, or we can recognize too that not everybody's going to hear that, and sometimes the tassels will be up, tassels will be down. But that's how we really take up this practice. And it isn't a particular way. Today we might say this, and it's right. And tomorrow we say this, and it's not right. And tomorrow we say that, and it's not right. Or it is right. So I don't know if this made any sense to you, what I said at the end, the hard part. But if in seeing that, what I tried to point out there, that will show you how it is that you get stuck, how it is that you get caught. And that will at least help you to free yourself, at least in this moment. Because it is fluid and everything is changing, you have to look again in the next moment. So we can start to learn to move out of awareness. Just coming back to this and not making anything of it, but knowing that it is absolutely critical that we're back here. Okay, well, anyway, I probably ramble on enough about that one. Any questions about anything I said here? Yeah, Mike.
Yeah, if existence and non-existence are two extremes, where does the consciousness come from that asks the question, why is there something as opposed to nothing? How can you have consciousness without someone who is conscious?
I don't know, but you do. But the someone who is conscious, don't you see that that is something formed because we have bought into the notion that there's particularness in the first place? If you look at that picture, there's really no particularness there at all. See, we say there's thinking, you know. Descartes says, I am thinking, therefore I am. He forgot that he just inserted the I out of nowhere, I. Well, no, wait a minute. You just can't start out with that. And he says, I am thinking. Well, okay. Therefore, I am. But what's thinking? There's thinking, yes. Thinking, immediately experienced. Get hold of it, though. But there it is, thinking, yes. What's thinking? You know, and I use that example, it is raining. And we say, it is raining. What is raining? We don't need a rainer to do the raining, see? It's just raining. We don't need a thinker to do the thinking. What's immediately experienced is the thinking or thought. Not the eye. The eye is an abstraction. But it is there because, in being deceived, we see solidity there. We don't realize it's abstract. We think it's solid. We think that's concrete. We think to question it is vague. Yeah. But were we to actually see this, not just think it and get the idea of it, but to actually see this, viscerally realize directly what our experience is. Of course, there's no our, no we, no me, no I having the experience. But there it is, it's directly. When we all experience this is all that's ever being experienced, just this. But we keep forming it into something. And then we wonder, why is there something as opposed to nothing? That's just the nature of mind. Nature of consciousness is to make it look like things are forming. Okay. And so that's why we don't have nothing, because there, look at these things forming here. We can't say there's nothing. Well, what's forming? Can't get hold of it. So in the end, these are the extremes. The metaphor of the extremes is really finally what it brings us to, is to start to notice this in our experience. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes?
I have a question about what the Buddha meant by the middle way, whether it's a static concept or a dynamic concept. What I mean by that is that it's possible to think about balance in a static way, that you go to market, a very simple market where they use scales, and there's a weight on one side and you put the produce on the other side until it balances. So that would be one way of understanding the middle way. It's a balance between two extremes. On the other hand, you can think of it as a dynamic, more like the yin-yang notion in China, where the sun or the earth revolves around the sun and we get our seasons, or day and night, that there's a gradual move from one side to the other, from darkness to light, and the grades in between, but it's a moving kind of a thing. I never thought to connect those before, but when the Buddha talks about the middle way, he's thinking about something that is dynamic or static?
Oh, no, it's something quite dynamic. But as I said, it involves the whole. And in viewing the middle way, we have to see things in terms of wholeness and totality and not particularness. The awakened, this is how they see things. You know, they don't see things... Well, they see the particularness, but they're not taken in by particularness. But what they see is the dynamic whole. So it is something... quite dynamic, but nothing you can get a hold of there. But it is in seeing this that we find the middle way.
So when the Buddha tries the way of asceticism, self-denial, no food, just about dies as a result, that would be one extreme. He had left the life of over-indulgence in food, that would be the other extreme. So he's saying there's nothing wrong with asceticism. Or there's nothing wrong with eating. It's you have to have both of them. Would that somehow be an example of the middle way?
You know, if you see in terms of the middle way, yeah, you would do just that, wouldn't you? In fact, does not seem even quite natural. So there's times when we're fasting, like right now, all of us, in a sense, we're fasting. I hope. I don't think anybody's chewing any candy bars out there or anything. And then there's times when we eat, yeah. But to go to either of these extremes, if we just continuously eat and eat and eat, you know, or we just cut it all together, these are not particularly healthy states. And both of those probably are being generated by disturbances in our mind, one way or another, unless we're forced into one situation or another. But you see, yeah, it is including the whole. We need both of these things. We'll fix on something that we like or don't like or whatever, and because we fix on that, we don't see the whole in which everything is taking place, and we can't find the middle way. The way to understand the middle way is to get outside of yourself. It's really what we're talking about. Just to forget the self, let that drop away, and see what's actually here. What's going on? This includes everything. You know, so that's how we find, and of course it's dynamic. But that's how we find the middle way. We don't actually find, it isn't like we find some particular spot, you see, but we live in a way that's balanced, which is, I think, what you were kind of alluding to there. Anything else? Yes?
So when people find they receive comfort in a consistent ritual, what I'm hearing from you today is that your action is more useful with the ritual, is that it's a tool to notice what's going on with your mind, and not be so focused on the actual consistency of the ritual, right? Because, like, say, other religious faiths, it's like the Catholic Church, it's all about ritual, and you have to stay this way, the only way you can see it. And people find comfort in that.
Yeah.
And of course it fails at times.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm hearing, like, the early ways, and, you know, if you do the station a little bit differently, not a big deal, you have a task about to have it down, no big deal, just notice. So, how do you keep students aware that it's not so much the consistency of the ritual, but the noticing of what's happening when you're...
Well, you just bring it up, point it out, you know, like I did today. And the thing is, though, that this is... all of us have a strong tendency to, you know, go to one extreme or another, whether it's to lose ourselves in a ritual or whatever. We'll start to discover when we allow ourselves to just kind of grow, become a little bit more magnanimous and our mind open and just seeing what's going on, we'll notice how it is that we might find comfort in these different things, but at some point these different things that we reach for comfort, want to kind of a wrap ourselves in or whatever, these things actually become kind of like prisons, you know, and actually block us from seeing what is really going on. And of course, much of the time we're kind of afraid to see what is going on. But why are we afraid to see what's going on? Even though what you'll find if you did see what was going on is total liberation, to the extent that you're seeing, you're liberated. Why wouldn't we go there? Well, it's because we are used to grasping and holding this particular way or this particular thing or this particular identity, that we think that that's what we need to sustain us. We don't realize that that kind of binds us, puts us in a prison, sets us up in opposition to other and all the rest of that, and causes a lot of difficulty for us. We'll hang on to the very thing that causes misery and injury for fear that if I didn't have that, I don't know what I would do, you know. But of course, at some point, if we can let that drop away, you realize you're still here. Well, I think probably has gone long enough, so I better end it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.